Welcome to the latest of the Greater Manchester Poverty Action podcasts. I'm John Hacking. I'm the coordinator for the Greater Manchester Living Wage Campaign. And today I've got Callum Carson with me, who's a researcher at Manchester Metropolitan University, who's going to be talking to us about some research on living real living wage that he's been doing. So welcome, Callum.
Thank you. Nice to have you.
And if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us about the research you undertook and what you were looking to find out, that would be really good.
Yeah, sure. So as John says, I'm a researcher at Man Met University based in the business school. And this PhD was done at the University of Leeds from 2015 to 2020. And it's a real kind of multidimensional exploration of kind of the impact of the real living wage on the UK economy. So it's, you know, there's four kind of levels to it. So it's, why did employers decide to adopt the living wage? What were the organisational impacts of implementing it? What impact does adoption of the living wage actually have on the low paid workers who are paid it? And then what's the kind of wider role of the living wage campaign within the UK economy?
Excellent. So just what, in terms of the what you were trying to find out, they were both from the employer's perspective and from the recipients, the employee's perspective. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. There wasn't much of an evidence base when I began my PhD looking at why employers had decided to accredit. There was a lot of research on workers themselves and the impact it had there. But I thought one of the good ways of trying to get more employers to accredit was if I could take my evidence base of employers saying, we weren't sure about this, but we went through with it and it turned out to be a good thing to skeptical employers. And then they could be like, okay, other employers have looked at this, have been a bit worried, but have seen that it ultimately works. And that would might kind of push them over the line. So that was the idea, really. And then to get the perspective of people in the middle within these organizations, so like in HR, procurement, the people who grappled with the issues of implementing it, how they got through their challenges.
Right.
And then to see it from the worker perspectives within these organizations as well.
Right. It's interesting that, because a lot of the work that we've done as part of the campaign, the Greater Manchester campaign, has borne out that fact, really, that employers are far more likely to be influenced by, well, this is what our experience is, I'd be interested to see if your research backed it up, is they're far more likely to be influenced by sort of peer-to-peer pressure rather than, you know, they're a lot more likely to listen to other businesses that have been through the process rather than to people like me who aren't active in business on a daily basis. Is that something that you found, generally speaking, was the view of employers?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a lot of talk of, you know, it's one thing for, you know, an academic to come in and say this or a campaigner to come in and say this, because you kind of, as an employer, you assume their perspective. You know, they want an employer to voluntarily do a good thing, but what's in it for the employer besides, you know, the kind of ethical motivations behind it? But when you said to them, other people in your sector have done this, you know, you might think right now this is too difficult, there's too many roadblocks, but here is another employer in a similar position to you that's not just been able to do it, has also, you know, benefited from it in terms of a business case afterwards when they weren't expecting to.
Yeah.
And just showing that has been done and is being done by other employers sometimes really helps them get over the line, because they can also, like, I've often spoken to employers who did accredit who said, yeah, I rang up, you know, a friend I knew in a company down the road who'd accredited, and he taught me through it.
Okay.
And that kind of informal process was quite useful as well for convincing some decision makers.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that sort of mutual support and mutual handholding is something that we've seen on the ground, and does, I think, as well, I don't know whether this came across, that there's almost a kind of peer pressure within certain sectors. You know, if one, you know, to take a, you know, construction or whatever, you know, if all your peers are doing it, there seems to be some kind of, you know, informal sense of pressure to be seen to be doing what appears to be the right thing. Did that come across at all?
Yeah, that came up quite a lot. You know, the notion of also, if everyone's doing this in this sector or this area of, you know, this local labour market, you don't want to be the last one to do it. Because A, it looks, you know, it looks bad reputationally, but B, the higher quality candidates at recruitment stage are going to go to the companies that pay the real living wage.
Yeah.
Even if they're not at, you know, even if they're not going for a job that's paid at the living wage rate. If you're looking at an organization you want to work for, seeing that, you know, accreditation plaque, it makes a difference to how you'd feel about your employer. So the peer pressure can go both ways. It can, you know, it can be encouragement, or it can be a bit of a, you know, a bit of a kick up the bum incentive as well.
Yeah. So there's a, I mean, I think one of the things that we've identified is that carrot and stick approach. And I mean, I suppose one of the, probably not the best way to describe it as a stick, but certainly building the procurement frameworks, particularly in public sector procurement, has an influence over whether employers, you know, if they know that they're going to be required to be living wage employers in order to bid for certain contracts or bid for work with some of their main contract suppliers. Was that something that you found employers were experiencing?
Yeah, there were some cases of kind of living wage accreditations going like down through the supply chain, sometimes almost by accident. So there was one employer I spoke to in like the northwest of the country. Sorry, I have to be vague because anonymous case studies. Who had subcontracted out their cleaners to a cleaning firm. And the cleaners who were working for this organization on those contracts were being paid at the living wage rates, but the other cleaners at other ones weren't.
Right.
And what ended up happening was there was so much internal strife within this kind of subcontracted agency that the agency just went, we should just accredit to stop, you know, people complaining about the differences. So it was almost like they weren't looking to accredit as a living wage employee, but they ended up doing it because of the filter down effect from a large employer that they relied on for a contract as a contractor, implementing the living wage themselves.
I think that's happened quite, I think that's starting to happen more and more. I think as public procurement, I think, get a grip of the concept of the importance of the real living wage. And I know that in parts of Greater Manchester, there are areas where particularly local authorities have built sort of strategic social value frameworks where, you know, living wage is part of a structural process of engaging contractors. So it does seem to be that employers are pushed and, you know, both pushed and pulled into it, which is interesting. I just wonder if we could just talk a little bit about how you went about conducting the research, how you, you know, what, who did you talk to, and what was the sort of, I'm not an academic, but I think the word's methodology, is that, hey, good. Well, you could tell us. Yeah, you could, the dreaded word. Yeah, you could tell us.
Well, I won't go into my theoretical frameworks either. So it was a qualitative research methodology. So, you know, interviewing people. So on average, an hour interview with people. So I interviewed 85 people, which is far too many for a PhD.
Right.
And nobody told me to stop and I was interested. So I just kept going. So I would contact the employers often via Twitter or email and say, you know, this is what I'm looking at. It's all anonymous. Here's all the details. Could I interview not just you, but also the people? So I wanted to interview three key groups of people at each employer, which was the decision makers who'd agreed to accredit as a living wage employer, the people who actually implemented it and did the nitty gritty. So HR, procurement, people like that, finance, facilities. And then, the workers who'd been either uprated to it, who were already there, or people who'd come in afterwards and were being paid it.
Right.
Just to see if the living wage, if they felt it was enough, if they felt it had changed how they felt about their employer, those kind of questions.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, I also interviewed a lot of the living wage campaign. So you know, like Catherine Chapman, the director of the Living Wage Foundation, and a lot of the key campaign program managers there, and then within Citizens UK. And then I would also interview people within like local councils who'd done things like you said about flexing their procurement muscles to kind of incentivize or even, you know, push other employers in their local areas to begin paying the living wage. So it was kind of just mapping out the impact that the living wage had had at each separate level. And 5 years was a long time, but I could have done it for another five. It's just fascinating.
Right. Was it over a 5 year period?
Yes. Well, I started it September 2015.
Right.
And then I took 6 months out to go work at the International Labour Organization in the UN in Geneva on the kind of wider decent work agenda.
Right.
And then I came back and then I did all the interviews and then analyzed all the interviews and then COVID hit as I was writing up.
Yeah.
And I'd got a nice month start on COVID because I broke my ankle a month.
Oh, dear.
So I'd had a month's lockdown already.
Oh, blimey.
So 2020 to me was just a year of writing up all this research and making sense of it. And then the last couple of years have been recovering from it.
But it gives it, I know it's apart from the broken ankle and the lockdown, it does mean that it was done over a longish period. So you got probably to see some changes and aspects of it that, if you'd done it all in 6 months, you'd have seen a much narrower snapshot, I guess. So, you saw the impact of changes in the rate and all the rest of it. Just interested in, you mentioned the group of people that we often, we either talk to as a campaign, we often talk to employers. And that's usually either small business owners or, you know, senior managers in private sector companies, or we talk to workers either directly or through trade unions. Mm. The group you mentioned I'm interested in is the ones we probably never talk to, the people who actually have to implement it.
Mm.
And I just wonder what your general feeling about their view of it was. Are they just, it's just another job to do, so we just get on with it? Or did they take what was their view really?
Yeah, I mean, the overwhelming view was they took a lot of pride in it. You know, there was a lot of these kind of jobs are quite processy, you know,
they're just
dealing with the day-to-day organizational aspects of a company. And it's not often you get to, you know, get your hands on something that is going to have a direct impact on so many people's lives.
Yeah,
so people often refer to it as, you know, the best thing they've done in their career so far.
Really? Thanks.
Yeah, which was really great to hear, because it made me think of like the buy-in, you know, of workers are affected, employers decide to accredit, employers get good reputations for doing it.
Yeah,
but then every single one of those people who'd helped implement it within an organization could maybe then go talk to a friend who owns a small business, or, you know, like the ripple effects from them all being on board with it, I think is so useful and beneficial for like the wider, you know, reputational pushing out of the living wage.
I think that's a really useful finding, actually, because, you know, quite often they're the group of people that, you know, when we talk to employers, owners, they always quite often give the impression that they are very much in favor of doing it, but wait, will they have to tell their finance director that he or she's got to implement it and what they've got to do and all the rest of it? And actually, it's quite interesting that, you know, it is something that people are quite positive about and see has a real value to it.
Yeah, definitely.
It's quite, no, it's fine. It's just a really good, it's really good to hear that, because we often got the impression that we're just giving these people more work to do than they want to do, really, or they feel like they need to do. Can I just in the last few minutes, if there were two things that you found out that you wanted to share with us, what would they be?
Well, two things.
Or as more than two, if you, what key findings really would you say?
It's dangerous just giving me a length of rope when I'm an academic.
Well, it's all right. Don't worry.
No, I can do two. Okay, so, you know, one of the core findings about why employers decide to implement the living wage is it's a real mixture of they think it's the right thing to do, or they think, you know, that there's a good business case for it, which there is. And no company's journey towards accreditation is the same.
Right.
So the people who push internally, the people who push externally, it's all very different. The internal dynamics, the external dynamics of the individuals involved is so different. But yeah, the two kind of core reasons to accredit were it's the right thing to do, or there's a strategic reason to do it. And then for a lot of the ones that just did it for the right reasons, they ended up finding in the future, oh, people are leaving less, people are happier at work, they're more loyal to their company, which is a kind of common sense argument that you wouldn't think there needs to be research around. So that's one finding. And then the second one, which was really interesting when you were saying about the five-year period, was that the workers I spoke to about why they were, the impact of being paid the living wage, said it wasn't just the rates of pay that were important to them, it was also guaranteed hours at work. You know, they needed guaranteed hours as well as a living wage rate of pay. And because of that 5-year period, and I was interviewing the Living Wage Foundation, I got to see them develop their living hours campaign as I was getting these findings from workers. So I could really see like this evolution of like the decent work agenda towards it's not just wages, it's also hours.
Yeah.
Other elements have come in over time. So it would be right thing to do. Business case for implementing the living wage, and then hours are important as well as wage rates at the workers' level. That's my two.
Those are brilliant. Thanks, Callum, for your time. Do I call you Dr. Callum?
You can do. I always find it a bit. I'm always waiting for somebody to go, that's not right. This was a mistake. That's working
class syndrome, I think. What do they call it? Imposter syndrome. That's it. Anyway, well, you're definitely not an imposter. it's fantastic work you've done. And I know you've shared it widely as well. I know that the Greater Manchester Living Wage Action Plan have found it very useful. Yeah. So I hope our listeners will find that interesting. And I appreciate your time today and wish you well. And thank you very much for your time and your input.
That's great. Nice to talk to you, John.
Cheers.